Today we are going to begin our discussion of the carbonyl bond and reactivity of aldehydes and ketones. But we did have one reaction we ran out of time for yesterday, which was the pinnacle rearrangement. So I had mentioned that as a problem that was at the back of the text. How many of you looked at that problem last night? How many of you have read the sections that correspond to today's lecture? Because even if I didn't upload the notes, you do have the syllabus posted now, don't you? Now, that wasn't very many hands. I'll just remind you that we have the conversion of alcohols to bromides, chlorides, iodides, and tosylates. We have the reaction of alcohol with sodium metal and sodium hydride to make alkoxides. We have the Williamson ether synthesis. We have the dehydration of alcohols, and we'll have those reactions of aldehydes and ketones that you learned today. That's an awful lot of information to get behind on this early in the quarter. I hope the fact that you don't have other classes on Monday and you don't have this class on Thursday or Friday is going to give you the chance to catch up, right? Okay. Let's go over the pinnacle rearrangement, though. And that involves this symmetric diol. So it's a double tertiary alcohol. Let's see what happens when we react this with H+ and then dehydrative conditions. So repetition of the mechanism we saw yesterday. Alcohol initially gets protonated in a reversible reaction. We form water, which is a leaving group, which can therefore leave. And we have a tertiary carbocation, which we might think would be the most favorable carbocation that we could have. But you know, what is it that makes a tertiary carbocation so stable? Hyperconjugation. What if we had true conjugation to stabilize a carbocation instead? Is there a way we could achieve that? Turns out the answer is yes. If one of these alkyl groups from next door migrates over to the carbocation, which is a similar process to a hydride shift, then if that were to occur, yes, it means that we technically end up with just sorry, that's wrong. One second. We make something that's now technically a secondary carbocation, but it's not a normal secondary carbocation because we do have the lone pair from oxygen right next door, which can now undergo resonance. What we end up with as a result is a carbonyl, which after deprotonation gives us a neutral molecule. Now, I meant to look this up because I am curious my own self. This original compound is called pinacol, and the product is pina colone, but I don't honestly know if it has anything to do with pina coladas or not. In other words, whether this has to do with pineapple or not. It could very well be the fragrant component of a pineapple. That's what I want to go look up. But this is the pina colone rearrangement. Very classic example of an alkyl shift. Questions about this or any of the reactions that we did yesterday? Yes. No, not deliberately, but it's more just because of time, I guess. The question was asked, what happened to the six aspects of a reaction? I've been hoping, I guess, that you all were able to determine those on your own selves at this point. Now, particularly newer students, if you don't know how to do it, then please come to office hours or during lab at any time, come and ask me. Returning students, if you're not sure yourselves what those six aspects are, then again, come to office hours or ask me during lab. To just breeze through it for this case, this is not its own special reaction in a sense. It's just an example of rearrangement. But if you wanted to have its own flashcard, you could say the purpose of this is to convert a vicinal diol into a ketone. That's what we have as far as functional groups. The reagents are just acid and heat. There are no special conditions other than it would be, you don't want water, you're trying to remove water. You've seen the mechanism for this reaction. Stereochemistry, there's none to be worried about in this case because we don't end up with stereocenters. But the main feature of this reaction is that, yes, for in terms of regiochemistry, there is an alkyl shift that has occurred. Other questions? Yes. This is resonance, yes. When the carbonyl forms, it's just a resonance step. All right, well, let's move on into the reaction of aldehydes and ketones since we have now just made a ketone. As a reminder, the main difference between those two functional groups is what? What is the difference between an aldehyde and a ketone? An aldehyde, you have to have at least one hydrogen on the carbonyl itself. It turns out, in fact, that by having a hydrogen there instead of an alkyl group, it makes a more reactive functional group, which I might have mentioned that that's part of the reason why, in terms of naming, aldehydes are more important than ketones. Aldehydes happen to be more reactive than ketones. Anybody know reason why? Yes. Okay, so that's actually the same answer that I got in the other section, that it has something to do with electronegativity, which might that might be a component of it. But there's an even stronger influence. Yes. Ooh, okay, that's something I forgot to talk about. That yes, it is true that aldehydes do have less steric hindrance. There's yet one more factor, though. What was the factor in what determined that a tertiary carbocation was more stable than a secondary than a primary? Hyperconjugation. And why was that true? Because hyperconjugation provides more electron density to stabilize that positive charge of a carbocation. And in that case, that's what made it easier to form. But we're talking about the reactivity of a carbonyl. What if it turns out hyperconjugation is also the reason here why there's a difference in reactivity? To better explore that, let's compare two different molecules. Let's look at ethanol. And let's, to understand how this thing reacts, draw a structural molecular orbital graph. For the new people, that's abbreviated SMOG, which is a diagram, the intent of which is to show what kind of orbitals are in a molecule, and more importantly, how do those orbitals interact with each other. So this phrase is structural molecular orbital graph, or SMOG. In a SMOG diagram, I do not worry about the shading of orbitals in terms of their wave function. So hopefully you remember something about wave functions and orbitals, the fact that if we're paying attention to sign of the wave function, an S orbital is all shaded the same way, a P orbital has one half shaded different than the other half, a D orbital has every other lobe, every other color, but that's not what this diagram is going to show. The coloring when I do these diagrams is just to show what kind of orbital that we have. Now, if we're going to show kinds of orbitals, though, we need a reminder about how to determine hybridization. So what is the hybridization of the carbon in the carbonyl? sp2, and how did you determine that? Okay, the number of domains, meaning the number of directions that there's bonding occurring, The way that I normally express that is to say the number of sigma bonds. Because remember that because pi bonds have their electron density above and below the direction of the bond, they don't effectively count for Vesper theory. Another reason we can rationalize that is in a double bond, that's the same as having one electron extra on each atom, which single electrons, as we discussed just I think the other day, don't count towards Vesper, don't count towards hybridization. So it's number of sigma bonds, or if you did have a lone pair, that would also count towards hybridization. We only have the 1, 2, 3 sigma bonds in this case. 3 sigma bonds requires 3 hybrids, which is why we end up with sp2 hybridization. What about the methyl groups? In this case, methyl group. sp3, because there's 4 bonds total. There's the bond that's explicitly written to the carbon, plus there's the other 3 hydrogens that are surrounding it. So in terms of hybridization, we've got sp3, sp2. I count the oxygen as sp2. And then hydrogen is never anything except S. So let's draw this picture out. If I say that it's got sp2 hybridization, that automatically means there's 3 hybrids that come from it. I know I'm going to be writing a pi bond, so just from practical experience, I know that I want to write my sp2 in such a way that I don't overlap with the p orbitals, making it a clearer structure to read. So I keep that in mind as I start writing these out. That could be the sp2 from the carbon, so now let's do the sp2 from the oxygen. I'll go ahead and write the 2 p orbitals that are in there, because if we have sp2 hybridization, there is that 1 p orbital automatically left over. So anytime there's sp2, there's automatically a p orbital. That p orbital is going to form a pi bond. Now what else do we have attached? We have the hydrogen's s orbital on one side. We have the sp3 hybridization on the other. sp3 automatically means there's 4 orbitals there, one of which comes back to the carbon it's connected to, the others of which are connected to hydrogens, which are also just s hybridized. For those of you who are writing in color, and again, particularly for the new students, I try to be consistent as far as what colors I use in these types of diagrams, so you do not have to follow this at all, but I generally make my sp3s purple just because I like the color purple. sp2s blue. Green would be sp, but we don't have any in this case. P orbital red, s orbital black. Now, what would be the instructional point of drawing the diagram like this? To view this and notice that the hydrogen that's connected to the carbonyl is on a bond that is perpendicular to the pi bond. So there's absolutely no way that that hydrogen can overlap with the pi bond. In aldehydes, there is no overlap between the bond connecting the hydrogen to the carbonyl and the pi bond from the carbonyl. Since they are orthogonal to each other. So slightly different molecule, slightly different situation, but same story, as you could say, as if we looked at a methyl group and why a methyl carbocation is not stabilized at all, because that's the same situation. Hydrogens would end up being perpendicular to the p orbital just the same way here. Now, how is this different from in a ketone? We could, in principle, just look at the methyl group on the aldehyde to answer the question, but just to have a little more practice drawing these diagrams, let's do a full smog diagram now for a ketone. And let's use acetone as our example. Which you do need to know this common name. Now, I know we covered common names of ethers yesterday, but we didn't do aldehydes or ketones. We'll tackle that in a week or so. But I do want you to know, because you're already using it in lab, what acetone is. And this particular aldehyde I showed doesn't have a common name that I can think of that's terribly important, but there is one other aldehyde that you need to know the common name of, and that is formaldehyde, which is related to formic acid, which that name comes from mica, which is Latin for ant. And that's related to the fact that formic acid is often found in some of the stinging components of ant bites. So, just a little random trivia. On acetone, we have very similar hybridization as we did in ethanol. The central carbon, the one on the carbonyl, is sp2 hybridized. The two different methyl groups are sp3 hybridized. So let's draw a quick smog diagram for this. Going to look very similar. Still have the sp2 hybridized carbon and oxygen, which means we're still going to have a pi bond. The only main difference, in fact, is that on either side of the carbonyl, we have an sp3 hybridized carbon. What's the instructional point of a diagram like this? The fact that we can show that the neighboring sigma bonds on the carbon one away from the carbonyl are now of the correct geometry, or close enough, that there is overlap between the sigma bond and the pi bond, which means there is hyperconjugation that can occur. Now, why does this matter? Well, there's a duality in the way that carbonyls tend to react. And it has to do with the fact that a carbonyl is automatically a polar bond. If we look at the structure of acetone, oxygen is the more electronegative atom, and so it has a partial negative charge to it. The carbon, in response, has a partial positive to it. Well, these opposing charges are what lead to opposing types of reactivity. The two reactions we're going to learn today, one of them is a cationic reaction, which, since oxygen is partially negatively charged, it would be attracted to reacting with things that are cations, things that would be electrophiles. So, in fact, one of the reactions we're going to see is protonation of an oxygen, a cationic reaction. We're going to find out, in fact, that many of these cationic reactions of aldehydes and ketones are reversible reactions. The opposite would be the fact that we do have this delta positive carbon that could be attacked by some form of nucleophile. So we're going to see that there are reagents that will force this carbonyl bond open. And because of the fact that they force their way open, many of those reactions are irreversible. So, the carbonyl bond has two main flavors of reactivity due to the fact that it has a plus end and a minus end. Well, the stronger the plus and the minus are, you might imagine the stronger reactivity that carbonyl is going to have, the enhanced reactivity. Well, if you have a ketone like this, where you have a neighboring alkyl group that is providing electron density into that carbonyl bond, you're reducing the polarity of that carbonyl bond. Which, if I just made this link between polarity and reactivity, if you've lowered the polarity of that carbonyl bond by squeezing some electron density into it, you've now made it less reactive. And this is the reason, one of the prime reasons, that ketones are less reactive than aldehydes, because of the hyperconjugation that occurs between the neighboring groups of the carbonyl on a ketone that you only have at most one of for an aldehyde, or formaldehyde, you don't even have that. It's just hydrogens. So let me write this reasoning down. In a ketone, both of the groups attached to the carbonyl are able to undergo hyperconjugation with the carbonyl. Hyperconjugation effectively reduces the polarity of the carbonyl bond, which therefore reduces its reactivity. And I'll put a little bit of a clarification here. Hyperconjugation reduces the polarity of the carbonyl bond because hyperconjugation is providing electron density to that delta positive carbon. And then finishing that off, hyperconjugation reduces the polarity of the carbonyl bond, which therefore reduces the reactivity of the carbonyl. So, aldehydes lacking some of that hyperconjugation and being sterically less crowded are more reactive than ketones. Questions? Then let's look at our first of two prototype example mechanisms. We're going to examine a cationic mechanism involving aldehydes and ketones, and we're going to look at an anionic mechanism. Why is it that we're looking at these two particular reactions out of order? Meaning, why are we doing this at all if we're in an alcohol chapter? Well, because we just made a ketone in lab yesterday. And the next lab, the next one we will start, is a reduction of a ketone. So I feel better having some context to be able to explain those labs in by showing you these couple of reactions. Because on Tuesday, we're going to learn not just the lab mechanism, but in lecture, we're going to discuss oxidation as well. And in oxidation, there's a chance for a side reaction, which we're going to see the side reaction today. So it's all going to come together next week. We're also going to be learning a reduction today, and reduction is the type of reaction that you're doing for your second experiment. So one's a good cationic example, and it's related to our material, and one's a good anionic reaction and related to our lab. So let's do the cationic one first. So this is the formation of a hydrate. The way this would look synthetically is an aldehyde or a ketone can reversibly react with water and an acid catalyst to become hydrated, much in the same way that an alkene can be hydrated to form an alcohol. But because there's already one oxygen on this double bond, then when we add water, we end up with a second OH group. So in fact, another term for a hydrate
is a geminal diol.
Geminal, like Gemini, meaning twins. So geminal diol means a twin diol. Twin meaning that both of the OH groups are on the same carbon. This is a fully reversible mechanism. So just like we did for hydration and dehydration of alkenes, I'm going to show you hydration and dehydration of first a hydration of a ketone and then dehydration of what would have come from an aldehyde.
So first the hydration. The first time I show this mechanism, I show it with four distinct steps. First step is much like what we would have if we were trying to react with an alcohol.
The only logical thing that could happen is that that carbonyl gets protonated. Now again, later on, we're going to see anionic reactions where instead of bothering with the oxygen, we're going to just have something plow right into the carbon. But water is not a strong nucleophile, so water can't really attack the carbonyl directly, which is why the acid catalyst is there to help pull the carbonyl along into being reactive.
So that proton can reversibly add. Once it does add, we have to realize there's effectively a bond opening that can occur, at least on paper. I say on paper because this is delocalized, so it's not really bouncing back and forth between these two structures, but it is the way that we write it down. So now first step we had something protonate. Then again the bond in the second step opens. We now have this carbocation that something can come in and attack. A little anthropomorphization there. And like so many times in the past and the future, when we have something neutral like water attack, there's going to be a deprotonate step that happens next. This sequence of steps, I give the odd acronym name POD to, only because you're going to see this sequence, protonate, open, DAC, deprotonate, dozens of times over the course of both this quarter and next quarter. So if you can remember the sequence of steps, it's going to get you through a lot of mechanism problems in the future. Now, this is the forward mechanism. I did say I wanted to show you a reverse mechanism just so that we had done it. I showed a ketone being made into a hydrate. Let me take the hydrate of an aldehyde to go in the reverse direction just to have something different. So this would be dehydration. How could I recognize that I had a hydrate that came from an aldehyde versus a ketone? That's mainly why I wanted to do this example. It's because wherever the two OH groups do meet, that common carbon, that's where the carbonyl carbon had to be. Notice that attached to that carbon, I have a hydrogen there. That's how I know that this would have in the past been an aldehyde. Now, I think I mentioned yesterday the principle of microscopic reversibility, which I might not have reminded us all what that is, but it is exactly this, that in some sort of process, whatever the energetically most likely pathway is in the forward direction through that process must automatically be the energetically most favorable pathway coming in the reverse direction. An example I often give for that is if you're going from here over the hills to Santa Cruz, if you found the easiest way to get over, it's automatically the easiest way to get back. Because if you found an easier way to get back, that's what you would have originally taken to get there.
And chemically, the same thing is true. And what that means is that every single step of reaction in the forward direction, you take exactly the same steps in the reverse reaction, which I think I pointed out with hydration and dehydration of alkenes. Works the same way here with aldehydes and ketones. The last step in forming the hydrate is for a proton to come off, so the first step in decomposing a hydrate is for a proton to come back on.
Which is reversible. But it does make water as a leaving group, which can then leave. The bond opens up, forming a carbocation, which is right next door to an alcohol. So we have a resonance structure that can occur, or it is delocalized, better way to say it. And that carbonyl, once formed, can then lose its hydrogen, become deprotonated.
Okay, now a random thought that I forgot to mention to the other two sections. I follow the habit of writing my hydrogens in on the carbonyl to show an aldehyde, even though, technically, according to the way we write line structures, we wouldn't need to show that aldehyde. It would be understood. But I guess because I first learned aldehydes writing it that way, and many textbooks do show the hydrogen to help show that it's an aldehyde, I've realized at some point I have unconsciously just followed that habit. So I just wanted to point it out in case the thought occurred to you. I could leave that hydrogen off in all of these structures, and they would be correctly written. But I'm writing it to help emphasize it's an aldehyde. Now, to come back to this abbreviation PODE, recognize that in this reverse direction, I could still show that this first event is something getting protonated, and that afterwards water, its bond opens up, and then the lone pair on the oxygen attacks the carbocation, and then you have the carbonyl deprotonate afterwards. So the same mnemonic device, the same acronym could be used in either direction. Open meaning that the bond opens up. It means in this case that it's breaking, that something is opening. For the hydration, same thing, that the double bond, one of the bonds opens, becomes broken. So it's not opening like a door, but opening that the bond is moving and it's so, but PBAD doesn't make a good acronym. Protonate, break, attack, deprotonate.
Well, I mean, the hydration makes the molecule. That's also breaking up bond.
But it's a deprotonation step.
No, I mean, the hydration.
Right here?
Yeah.
But it's a deprotonation. Yes, it's a bond breaking, but it's a specific kind. It is a deprotonation event. So it's a very specific bond breaking. Yes?
For dehydration, why do you say it's open? The water doesn't leave?
Yes, the water does leave.
Because the water leaves, then it opens the...
Don't worry so much about the word open. I can substitute any word I wanted there. But it makes the acronym easy to say, which is why I chose the word open. And remember that in English, many, many words don't mean what they mean when we use them in science. That we might have some definition and use the word in science and mean something totally different. Yes? It is exactly the reverse reaction, yes. But I just wanted to formally show the mechanism so there would be no question that really it is the reverse reaction. Now, a comment about this hydration, which we'll get more into when we tackle aldehydes and ketones formally as a functional group. It turns out that small aldehydes, they favorably hydrate In other words, if we took formaldehyde and threw it in water, almost spontaneously, it's going to make the hydrate like this. When we have larger compounds, or particularly when we get to ketones, they're less polar compounds, they're less water compatible, and end up not as favorably forming a hydrate. So whereas something like 99% of formaldehyde would form a hydrate naturally, only something like 0.1% of acetone would. We'll recover that topic again later, but just wanted to point out, hydrate formation is not necessarily spontaneous. But whether it is or not, it's an equilibrium process. And the one idea from last quarter that we covered from equilibrium that we need to carry forward with us is that if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. Which means even if it's not favorable to hydrate, if it's a reversible reaction, a little bit of it will happen. And in fact, as we see in this case, cationic reactions of aldehydes and ketones, especially involving acid catalysts, are normally reversible reactions. Why? Because each one of the protonated intermediates has got about the same acidity level as any other of the protonated intermediates. In other words, there's no one really hugely bad intermediate that we make anywhere along the way. So whether we're starting from reactants or products, the activation barriers are not that much different in the forward and reverse reactions. And that's why this reaction is reversible. Yes? This is a reversible process, but and I should have written this down, but out loud I said I wanted to do hydration using a ketone example, and I purposely switched to a different molecule showing the dehydration example. So they're the same mechanism, different molecules. So let me put that in the writing for the 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 22, 4. Ooh, we almost have everybody here. So for just a couple of people that aren't here, section 1 and 2 didn't seem to have as much ability to get here for a Friday class. That doesn't mean you all get bonus points, but I'll think of you all fondly when I grade. Other questions about this cationic reaction? Then let's now do our prototype example of an anionic reaction, which is reduction. Which you're going to use one of these two reagents I'm about to describe in that second lab that we'll do, not next week because we only meet once, but the following week. There are two main reagents that we tend to use for reductions of aldehydes and ketones. One of them is the compound NaBH4, which is sodium borohydride. The same sodium borohydride that you saw mentioned in oxymercuration, demercuration last quarter. The other reagent is lithium aluminum or aluminium hydride. It is interesting that the standard name for AL, even in the U.S., is technically aluminium, although most U.S. citizens have probably never heard that word, because I guess our English got lazy at some point. So what's the difference in reactivity of these two compounds? Well, which is more electronegative, boron or hydrogen? Hydrogen. That's why in hydroboration oxidation, boron ends up at the less substituted position because it ends up acting as the electrophile. Where is aluminum versus boron on the periodic table? It's below it. It's in the same column as boron. If you don't remember that, that is an association now you need to make. So hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, blah, 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 blah. aluminum below it. If boron was already less electronegative than hydrogen, because boron is lower and to, well, let's just say it's lower than hydrogen on the periodic table. If aluminum's even lower, then what can we say about the electronegativity difference between aluminum and hydrogen? It's even larger, isn't it? Because aluminum is below boron, so it's a less electronegative atom than boron is, and boron is already less electronegative than hydrogen. So if the electronegativity difference between boron and hydrogen is smaller than aluminum hydrogen, then the aluminum hydrogen system is going to be more reactive because it's more polarized. And that shows up in the following way. Sodium borohydride, it is a source of hydride. So just like sodium hydride, it'll react with an alcohol. But we can get away with using an alcohol as a solvent because the reaction is slow enough that if you have a ketone or aldehyde dissolved in that alcohol solvent, in a protic solvent, the solvent will decompose, but not as rapidly as the reduction would occur. Lithium aluminum hydride would never, ever, ever attempt that, not if you didn't want to burn up the room. Because as an example, back in grad school, when I was at Berkeley, we had a few different rooms that were part of the same, under the same researcher, and there were four of us that started the group off originally. So two of us in one room, two in the other. Well, it was the other two that I didn't actually see it happen, but I know there was a bunch of commotion that happened over there involving a fire extinguisher because one of them was using a lithium aluminum hydride and was filtering it. Well, when it went dry, it got so reactive that it just reacted with the water in the atmosphere and caught on fire, which caught the solvent that was next to it on fire, which caught the next bottle over on fire, which nearly then caught that whole lab bench and the room on fire. So lithium aluminum hydride is a much, much nastier compound. So much difference is the reactivity between these two compounds that later on we're going to learn how to do tricks where we'll have multiple functional groups in a molecule and we'll be able to reduce one without touching the other. So for now, let me just comment on these reagents in general. The electronegativity difference between aluminum and hydrogen is much greater than the difference between boron and hydrogen. Lithium aluminum hydride is therefore a much more powerful reducing agent than sodium borohydride. And as I was mentioning, sodium borohydride can safely be used in protic solvents. You can't let them sit around all day because it will decompose. But the reduction is a favorable enough reaction, even under those conditions, that it'll happen and be over with before all the reagent completely decomposes. Now, it means you have to add a little extra. But sodium borohydride comparatively is not so expensive. So, in fact, in the reaction you're going to do, you're going to take a little bit of sodium borohydride, a little bit excess, throw it in an alcohol, throw in a ketone, and you're going to see you're going to get nearly 100% reduction, 100% yield on the reduction of that ketone.
So sodium borohydride can be safely used in many protic solvents. Decomposition will occur, but slowly enough reduction can still occur. And let me just show you what the side reaction is, because it's exactly what we saw with sodium hydride. So if we treat sodium borohydride as just a source of hydride, as we've seen before, an alcohol can be deprotonated, which will form an alkoxine and then also spit off hydrogen gas as a byproduct. Now, let's see the real reduction itself instead of just the byproduct. So we had something like butanal. The simple way of writing the mechanism is just to show that hydride attacking the carbonyl, and because there are already four bonds to that carbon, therefore you show simultaneously the carbonyl opening to form an alkoxide. Now, when we revisit this reaction later on, when we're really in the chapter on aldehydes and ketones, we might learn a few more details about this mechanism. Because technically, aluminum in lithium aluminum hydride or boron in sodium borohydride often complexes with the oxygen. And sometimes that's, in fact, pivotal to the mechanism of a reduction. For this first pass through, and because we're totally out of time, how did that happen? Wow, I need more caffeine before this section, I guess. So for simplicity's sake, I'm just showing you the hydride. Let me just take a couple of minutes to point out one important aspect of this reaction, that we start out with something hydride that is a strong base. I don't remember exactly what the pKa of hydrogen is, but hydride is definitely much, much more basic than the alkoxide that we form. And so in this example, reduction is effectively an irreversible reaction. In fact, I'll say it like this. Reduction, like many anionic reactions, is normally irreversible. Because of the large difference in basicities of the reactants and products. I know why we got behind. We did the pinnacle rearrangement. So let me give you two problems to work over the weekend then, that I'll start maybe even lab lectures so we can catch up a little.
with these two problems. These are our first foray into multi-step synthesis. So what I'm going to do is give you the reagent, the substrate, and I'm going to give you the final product. But I'm not going to tell you how many steps there are in between, and I won't tell you at all what the reagents are in between. That's what you've got to figure out.
This first reaction comes directly from our discussion yesterday, and hopefully will be relatively easy for you to figure out. Now, two comments I'll make about this.
First, an alcohol is not a leaving group, so you can't directly convert from this alcohol to this alkyl azide.
If you don't remember what azides are, the N3 ion, a source of azide would be something like sodium azide. And just to help you out, here is one of the possible resonance structures for the azide ion. The second problem is going to be a bit trickier for you. And you have learned all the reactions that would be needed to do this. The trick will be figuring out which ones and the proper order. Because notice we go from a tertiary alcohol to a primary alkyl halide. Any quick questions before we end for today? Then have a good weekend.